This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam peoples.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is August 5th, 2021, and this is episode 251.
I'm Scott Lundebaum.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we're kicking off the greatest BC premier bracket with the first round of premiers from the nonpartisan era. 30 years, and we had 15 premiers. Actually, it was 16. We're only going to do 14 today, though. Thank you to everyone who contributes each month or annually to keep this show going. Thanks especially to Nicolette for signing up recently. You can join them at patreon.com/politicoast. Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to politicstoday.news/free-trial. Let's get into the first section of this bracket. So just to give the broad overview, the way we set this up and broke this down is there are 35 premiers over BC's 150-year history as a province. A big chunk, as I mentioned, were from this pre-1906 era that were nonpartisan. We have another chunk that were New Democrats. We actually have had six New Democrat premiers. We've had eight Liberals over the time, two of them in the modern era, so they're a different breed, but I've bunched them together. We've had four social credits premiers and three conservatives, so they've all just been bunched by party because it had worked out that it was either going to be by party or by era, and for the most part, it works out just doing it by party. Like, the nonpartisan era is very clear. The conservative era was just shortly after that. It gets a little messy by mixing Dave Barrett and pulling him out of the, I don't know, middle 20th century and putting him with like John Horgan in the same bracket, but there we are. And yeah, we did include the latest premiers like Clark and Horgan, which will probably get a bit weird because their legacies haven't really been entrenched, but Horgan's the only NDP premier to have won re-election, so that's got to count for something maybe. I'm really curious to see where this is going. I'm also really excited about the nonpartisan bracket because I'm learning a bunch about all of these old racist white dudes who founded the province. I should be clear, some were not racist because they wanted cheap labor. So they were pro-Chinese immigration because they could have cheap labor in that case. Very interesting era. So we're going to start with the first 14 premiers. Voting will happen on our website through polls each week. There's six pairs matchups to vote for right now. You can go to politicos.ca/bracket. Link is in the show notes. It'll be all over our social media to vote for each of these pairings. We'll announce the winners next week. We'll jump into the next section of voting. I think we'll probably move over to the NDP first round and go around before we come back and see who comes out. Unless you really want to dig through all the nonpartisans first, Scott, to see who's the winner of that. We haven't fully figured this out yet.
Yeah, we're playing this by ear a bit on it. Yeah, it was good.
All right, let's see how this first preliminary round goes. Our first matchup, John Foster McCrate versus John Robson, the Battle of the Johns of the old era. John Foster McCrate was the first premier. He served from November 14th, 1871, the Confederation, to December 23rd, 1872. One thing you'll note with most of the premiers from this era, they served very short amounts of time because it turns out nonpartisanship is a terrible way to run a legislative government.
Something the Green Party should take note of.
Despite only serving for just over a year, McCrate's government passed 36 pieces of legislation. Now, it was a brand new government, so it was probably pretty easy to just say, we need all of these bills and get a lot of the basics passed, but 36 is up there with some of the more busy premiers like Dave Barrett, who we'll get to much later. McCreight, though, was known as being, and I'm quoting here from Wikipedia, bad-tempered and queer, by fits and turns extremely credulous and extremely suspicious, excessively obstinate in the wrong places, close and reserved in his daily life, and utterly ignorant of politics. That's a quote from one of his contemporaries.
That last one is quite a description and may help explain why I only served a year.
To be fair, been electoral politics prior to McCreight's premiership. So he comes in as the first premier. He does his best for a year and he loses a confidence vote in 1872. And that's the end of his era. He was our first premier. Probably most people don't know his name. I forget it quite often. Maybe he deserves your vote.
Yeah, and he'll be facing off against John Robson, who was the ninth premier from August 2nd, 1889 to June 29th, 1892. He became premier following the death of the previous premier, Alexander Davy. He supported the continued homesteading, basically the continued colonization of the territory, in part to prevent the U.S. from claiming the land, and supported a dry dock being constructed in the Esquimalt. And like his predecessor, he left office due to a bad case of death in 1892.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, after what has got to be such a anticlimactic way to die of hurting his finger in the door of a carriage when he was visiting London and dying of blood poisoning.
It's just,
aren't antibiotics great?
It was such a different time, right? You died of things that seem super preventable. And they are now, but in 1892, we didn't have a lot of things, and so you could die quite young. Robson was like one of three premiers in a row who died in office. He was the third of three who died in office, so unfortunate for him. There you go, McCreight versus Robson. Next up, we have Amor de Cosmos versus Edward Gawler Prior. De Cosmos was the second premier from December 23rd, 1872 until February 9th, 1874. The man obviously wasn't born Amor de Cosmos. He was born, I think, William Smith, which is why we have a Smythe later who didn't want to be named after the same guy. He changed his name because he was quite eccentric and loved the universe and wanted to be named I Love the Universe. We'll probably end up talking about him a lot more if he advances, so I don't want to talk too much about De Cosmos right now. I'm not presuming he will beat Prior, but De Cosmos is probably the only premier most people can name from this era. He was one of the many people pre-BC joining Confederation that really advocated for it. He really wanted to see responsible government here. He came in with a cabinet of reformers that really had this like liberal elite of the time view of trying to reform the province. And so he saw the development of a number of public institutions, including schools. But he was one of the first premiers to really go down in scandal, as became a long BC tradition. And here he had ventured into wanting to expand a steel industry in BC after he learned of iron deposits in Texada Island and coal in Vancouver. And he figured he could bring all of these resources together, start some smelting mills, and get a steel industry burgeoning in the province that would help build the railroad that they were still fighting for.
Yeah, those are the two critical ingredients in steel, so makes sense.
But he made the mistake of tying his personal business in. He was also premier on this and got accused of double dealing. He was ultimately found not guilty by a royal commission. Didn't stop him from having to resign in disgrace, though.
Edward Gawler Prior, he was 15th premier from November 21st, 1902 to June 1st, 1903. So got less than a year in. I was a mining engineer, federal conservative, I presume MP, but that's not actually strictly in the notes. He lost his seat to violations of ethics rules. So he served from 1895 to 1901, become the Minister of Mines and then Premier in 1902, was dismissed in 1903 due to conflict of interest allegation related to the construction contracts given to his own hardware, and he was the final Premier to be dismissed by a Lieutenant Governor.
As far as I can tell, that's true anywhere in Canada. I think William Eberhardt was almost dismissed by the Lieutenant Governor of Alberta, but I guess resigned just before. So Canadian premiers have a good history of resigning before they get forced.
That wasn't his final dealings with the viceregal office, as he was appointed to the position in 1919.
Yeah, we have here the lineup of the two who mostly went down in conflict of interest and scandal.
I should say died within a year of the appointing to the office. He actually died in 1920.
Pryor's was the final nonpartisan administration. I didn't see anything notable about what he did as premiers besides double deal. So Pryor versus DeCosmos. Next up, we have George Anthony Walcombe versus John Herbert Turner. Walcombe's the only premier in this list who served twice. He was the third and fifth premier of British Columbia, serving from February 11th, 1874 to February 1st, 1875, almost a year, and then June 25th, 1878 to June 13th, 1882. Four more years. He actually, that's a significant amount of time for a premier in this era. During his first tenure, he fought for the railway to get built, but was largely unsuccessful at that, as many of the first premiers were. BC joined Confederation on this promise to get a railway, and it took quite a while for it to finally reach here. In 1875, he fought an election during his first premiership, and his government was reduced to a minority. Now, it's a nonpartisan era, so minority is weird. It just meant more MLAs were elected who were running as quote-unquote opposition or independents rather than quote-unquote government MLAs. I guess the big issues at the time was Walcombe's failure to get the railway and the amount of money he was blowing on the development of the Lillooet Cattle Trail, which had been the largest public works project in the province at the time. So he kept his government after the election, but still lost a no-confidence vote and was replaced by Elliott, who we'll come to in the next round. Elliott ran a short-lived and unstable government, and so Walcombe came back to office after that failed and survived another no-confidence vote in 1882, which was triggered by rising construction costs of the Vancouver Island docks, but he was ultimately defeated in the 1882 election.
John Herbert Turner was the 11th, March 4th, 1895 to August 15th, 1898. It's also not a bad stretch for someone in this time.
18 months.
Pardon?
About 18 months, I think.
So he obtained the finance and agricultural portfolios. I guess back in the day, the premiers kind of dealt with a few other things. He was criticized for his lax fiscal control as deficits grew to $7.5 million, which was a 7 times increase since 1886. He faced accusations of corruption and an inability to distinguish between personal activities and political activities.
The election around this period resulted in a near tie between the government and opposition, a 2017 situation. The lieutenant governor demanded Turner resign. Didn't really want to, but ultimately did, which we'll get into later what that leads to. But this lieutenant governor was quite a thing.
And finally, according to the Canadian Encyclopedia, Turner's premiership marked the final firing of Victoria business class in BC politics.
I found that phrase really weird when I first read it, and I dug into a deeper bio of Turner, and I guess he was one of a number of elites from Victoria who'd gotten into politics, like the Dunsmuirs and the other mining barons and business owners. And so he was very well connected with them. And when he went down, that class never really recovered. Now, at the same time, Vancouver was also building up. What I also found interesting is Turner got coined Reaganomics is a thing now. Turnerism was a thing that he got accused of, just like wildly lavish spending. So Walcombe versus Turner, I think, is an interesting matchup. A lot of like bad spending on both of these premiers' parts. Yeah. Next up, we have Andrew Charles Elliott versus Charles Augustus Semlin. So Elliot was the fourth premier from February 1st, 1876 until June 25th, 1878, just over 2 years. He took over following Walcombe's defeat. He also couldn't progress the railroad. As I mentioned, he was premier for about 18 months. He raised taxes, didn't do very well, and in the 1878 election lost his seat and government, which led to the return of the Walcombe second premiership. So not particularly notable, but I don't know, maybe he'll somehow survive this round.
So Charles Semlin took over from Turner as the 12th premier in August 15th, 1898, and served until February 28th, 1900. Following the fall of the Turner government, the LG had called on Robert Bevin to form government. He couldn't. Semlin was next in line and took position.
Bevin, notably at this time, was not an MLA. Just a real, like, Lieutenant Governor McInnes, who I think we'll get into a little bit later, was a real piece of work.
So Semlin led a tough coalition that included a lot of people who were at each other's throats. He brought in the 8-hour workday for hard rock miners. He passed the Alien Exclusion Act to prevent Chinese from owning mine claims, which the federal government intervened to disallow the bill.
That's not the only time, it turns out, that the federal government had to say, BC, you're being too racist. We'll be a bit racist, but we can't be that racist.
So he tried to purge civil service of patronage appointments. After he forced his attorney general to resign, he failed to pass an electoral redistribution bill. So he advised the LG, but sought a chance to regain the confidence of the House, which the LG denied and instead asked Martin, his former attorney general, which he did, but we'll get into that next.
Yeah, so Semlin's era is interesting. He definitely went to war against the mine owning class by supporting, I think he really tried to support the views of the working class miners at the time, who were who held very strong unions, but were also very racist. Like, they did not want Chinese immigration because they viewed it as a way to undercut their own job security because they would be paid less.
Yeah, hardly the first time a tension between organized labor and immigration.
And so there's a lot of stuff in Semlin's premiership that I think is good for BC, like the 8-hour workday and trying to clean up the patronage stuff and the corruption in the bureaucracy. But things like the Alien Exclusion Act are very bad. And so I don't know where I fall on this tension with Joseph Martin, his attorney general, is quite interesting. And we'll dig into this as we get into the next lineup, because basically Martin goes to the Kootenays to try to stand up for this like Asiatic Alien Exclusion Act, saying the government should be fighting harder. And he actually like breaks ranks with cabinet, which is why Semlin forces him to resign. But while he's making this argument, the miners of the Kootenays end up breaking out into a brawl, and it gets quite ugly. So basically his attorney general starts a riot and then has to be asked to resign from cabinet, which almost didn't happen. So Semlin's government ends ugly, especially with the lieutenant governor just deciding whoever he wants to be premier, in a way. All of that versus Andrew Elliott, who is pretty unnotable. But now let's talk about the two, who I'm going to call the fake premiers. Robert Bevin, might be Bevin, I'm going to say Bevin, versus Joseph Martin. So Bevin was the sixth premier from June 13th, 1882 to January 29th, 1883. He took over following Walcombe's second resignation. So Bevin faced an election shortly after becoming premier, but lost it, essentially. Like, he kept his seat, but he didn't have enough seats to likely win a confidence vote. He just didn't recall the House until the end of the year. So he becomes premier in June, faces an election in July, doesn't do very well, but just keeps governing. During this time, he hosts a 3-month visit to BC by the Governor General of Canada, the Marquis of Lorne, and his wife, the Princess Louise. He asked the princess during this time if she wants to be queen of an independent Vancouver Island, which I guess she denied, unfortunately, otherwise.
That probably would have caused some tensions back home in England if that had gone through.
just what a wild, like, just a thing to propose, to put out there. Like, you're not, you have no mandate to govern, and yet you're already, like, proposing sedition, a breakaway.
Yeah, this was after the colonies had united, you know, Vancouver Island had joined BC.
Quite a while after, because BC had been in Confederation for over a decade, and it had like been united before that.
Yeah, this is such a weird thing to do. I don't know, it'd be like inviting Prince Harry to form like an independent New Brunswick or something. Like, it's an independent kingdom of New Brunswick. Like, it's just so odd.
So, Beavan eventually faces the House in December, loses a confidence vote shortly after, which is what leads to his resignation in January 1883. Can't say he accomplished much else as premier, though.
Although, if he had succeeded in making Vancouver Island independent, that would have been quite the legacy. So weird. Anyway, Martin, as we mentioned, took over from Turner after the whole kerfuffle that you just walked through. So after he took over...
How about I'll walk through it, because I have a sense of this. So Joseph Martin, by contrast, is the 13th premier from February 28th, 1900 to June 15th, 1900. Like, not even 3 months, or just over 3 months. Yeah, just over 3 months. He was nicknamed Fighting Joe. And as a bit of a reminder, you have this Lieutenant Governor McInnes who had dismissed Turner without allowing him to face the House, and then asked Beavan to form another government. Beavan, this is like 17 years after Beavan was originally premier and didn't have a seat in the House. And so Beavan said, I can't form a government right now. And so McInnes asked, Semlin governs for a while. Semlin kicks Martin out of cabinet. Martin goes and sits as leader of the opposition. The Semlin government gets dismissed by McInnes, again without allowing the premier to face the House, and Martin gets asked to form government. So Martin becomes premier, can't do much because he's now got to convince the House to come along with him. Martin, as a reminder, was a proponent of the Alien Exclusion Act, and that's what led to, he was such a proponent of it, he wrote it, and he was such a proponent of it, it led him to start a riot in the Kootenays. As premier, the political situation just descends into chaos. And maybe I'll let you take it from here.
Just not last long until he gets a non-confidence vote.
Yeah, it's literally a day after he's appointed premier, he goes to a non-confidence vote. Why don't you give us the results of that?
So it was a 28-1 vote. I presume Martin is the one on that.
He may have seen the writing on the wall. There's something at that point where you're like, I don't even want to be premier at this point. And then there's just a random. But yeah, despite losing this vote the day after he's appointed premier, he forms a cabinet and governs for 3 months until the 1900 election. Don't know how you can do that.
Pesky little things like non-confidence.
Didn't do well in that election. Of the 29 MLAs, his team only got 13 elected. Semlin's got 6. Semlin even lost his own seat. And so it goes on from there. The little side note of this is Prime Minister Laurier, just after the election, says enough with this and fires McInnes as the Lieutenant Governor of BC, because this is what happens when Lieutenant Governors don't heed the advice of the First Minister and go rogue.
Probably a good call on Laurier's part.
Not that there's any risk of a Queen's representative going rogue right now, despite Jagmeet Singh's implorations.
Yeah, now that we've got a slightly more stable one in Rideau Hall, it should be better.
In any case, I really like this matchup because you have, and I think I shifted some things around to make this happen, because you get Beavan, who, you get these two guys who basically govern with no authority to govern, one of whom who asks a princess to become Queen of Vancouver Island, and another who like epically loses a confidence vote and had started a riot. Now, the one guy is pretty racist, and I think that's a pretty good knock against him, but I'll let dear listeners be the ultimate vote on this. And the final matchup of the preliminary round of the nonpartisan era that we have, there are two more premiers, the Davy brothers, who we've just advanced because the numbers work out that way. But this is the battle of the other downtown Vancouver streets, William Smythe versus James Dunsmuir. Smythe was the 7th premier from January 29th, 1883 to March 28th, 1887. He initiated what was called the Great Potlatch Era, where generous grants of public resources and land were just given to private entrepreneurs. Another great BC tradition, I guess. He was able to successfully settle some disputes with the federal government that had stalled the CP railway construction. So that was a mark in his favor. He did pass a bunch of racist anti-Chinese law, including a fee of $10 that every Chinese person over 15 had to pay the provincial government. He said Chinese people could not acquire crown land. And he tried to pass a ban on Chinese immigration that the federal government stepped in and disallowed, and instead said, all right, we'll do a head tax instead. A full ban is too racist, but a...
That's pretty clearly extending the province's powers beyond what it can do. So they may have been inclined to step in on that one, on that account.
Yeah, Smythe's policies towards Indigenous people were not any more progressive. He generally tried to steal their land, and he argued that because Indians did not cultivate much land, they did not need much. So none of that was too great. He did, though, say when he was asked whether British Columbia should be annexed by the United States, he suggested Washington and Oregon should be annexed by British Columbia, which is pretty badass. Yeah, I suspect that sentiment goes back quite a ways. Nevertheless, Smythe dies in office in 1887 of nephritis just before his 41st birthday. So, not an old man.
And finally, James Dunsmuir, who's the 14th premier from June 15th, 1900 to November 21st, 1902. He was heir to the Dunsmuir family coal fortune. He was the leading force opposing organized labor in government. He tried to support Chinese immigration, in part to keep wages low. He promoted railway construction, redistributed seats. He resigned in November 1902 after visits to England and the U.S. and decided he didn't like politics, but didn't stay away all that long as he was appointed lieutenant governor in 1906.
Yeah, I can't say I'm a big fan of either of these premiers. One was pretty staunchly racist and problematic for a number of reasons, although was managed to be state premier for over 4 years, which is pretty big record for the era. And the other was a pretty hardcore union buster whose only reason for supporting immigration was to bust the unions. Cool. Very classic, quintessential BC history, though. So there you have it. 6 matchups. You have any sense of who you'll vote for?
I don't need to read more into these. This is a stretch of history that, if it wasn't for some of my reading on this, is somewhat foggy to me, as high school history class was a long time ago.
When I did my upbringing in Alberta school system, and we didn't cover BC premiers from this era at all. And
yeah, like,
I don't even hear they would have talked too much about these guys who served for 3 months or 18 months on average.
Yeah, like I know the broad strokes of the era, but the premiers were not a thing that I don't was covered in too much detail or that I can particularly recall.
When we get to the next round, we'll include Alexander versus Theodore Davie. Those are the only two premiers missing out of the nonpartisan bracket. So go to politicos.ca/bracket, look on our social media. The page is there. You can start voting. Tell your friends to vote. Hopefully you can only vote once. If not, I might be changing the polling for the next round. This is a trial one. I like legit don't expect any of these men to become the winner, but I wanted to learn about them.
Moving on from history to current events, let's go through some of the quick takes. First up, the second quarter interim financial reports are in from elections. The BC NDP was by far the leading fundraising party here, bringing in $834,576 from about 7,500 donors. I presume these numbers are rounded, because that would
The number of donors are rounded.
That would be a big coincidence if all of them happened to hit in the hundreds exactly.
It's a big haul. Yeah, a big haul for the NDP with like triple the number of donors of the other two major parties. It was also a very lucky quarter for them as they received a $153,000 almost bequest, which would seem to bypass the donation limits, but I guess there's a rule where if your will was written before January 1st, 2018, it's exempt. and you can just leave. You could have just left your entire estate to a political party, but
it's weird. Like, what? I can't imagine being so invested in politics that you would leave $150,000 to a political party.
I looked up who the person was, and it sounds like they really were involved in their local Vancouver Island, or it may have even been Gulf Island political party and the local New Democrat for decades.
Yeah, even so, like, I don't know, after you're gone, you can't exactly monitor this stuff. Like, you have no idea who's going to become, right, the next leader. It may be someone absolutely terrible that you would never want your money to support. I just can't put myself in the headspace of being that partisan.
Fair, me either.
Yeah, or that's a fairly significant sum, and like, would be, I don't know if they had, you know, offspring or heirs or whatnot. Yeah, give some of it to them or charity or something.
The BC Liberals were quite a bit back from the NDP. They only raised $313,514 from about 2,700 people. Maybe the BC Liberals can get away with the excuse that all their donors are supporting the leadership campaigns, who report separately and after the leadership campaign is done. Still really discouraging numbers from them, though.
Yeah, that is not great. It's up from their second quarter 2020 numbers, but they'd also just cut all fundraising activities from pretty much the start of the end of the first quarter, actually. Basically from March up until kind of midsummer on their part. And even then, they managed to pull in last year in that period $283,000 and change on that. So not great that when they're more actively soliciting donations, they haven't done that much better than when they weren't, and are not anywhere near where the NDP is on that, which is not a great sign. I mean, in theory, some of this, the donation money is going to the leadership candidates instead, but still, it's a worrying sign, especially if the Green Party is so close behind them, pulling in $287,827.
Yeah, the Green Party actually had more individual donors than the BC Liberals in this period. They had about 2,800. I think I calculated it out as 149 more donors for the BC Greens. Now, most of the BC Green donors were smaller. They only had a handful who were donating over $250. But the Greens are really starting to show some strength in terms of keeping their momentum going. First and Now, by all accounts, is doing a very solid job as leader in building the party and making a name for herself and distinguishing it from the Andrew Weaver party. Very strong support there. I think some of the recent poll numbers for the Greens have also been pretty strong. They haven't leapfrogged the BC Liberals on any polls yet, but they're closer together than either of them are to the NDP at this point.
I don't know the BC polling history card as well, but like typically, especially in the federal context, you typically see the Greens do pretty well between elections, as they're like a spot where people like to park their vote in terms of I'm not really super thrilled with any of the major parties at the moment, so I'm just going to say I'm going to vote Green. And that tends to collapse once it's actually time to vote. So I wouldn't necessarily read too much into the fact that just under a year after an election, they're polling not badly.
But still, interesting times in BC politics, and it is a pretty good sign for the government that they're not facing significant challenges from their opponents in the House.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a very worrying sign for the BC Liberals. From what I heard, but under the Wilkinson leadership, there was not a huge amount of efforts to reform the party's fundraising in light of the new election laws, and that is apparently continuing to be a problem. And that they definitely have access to people who are good at small dollar donation fundraising, which I'm not super thrilled with. I think it tends to be a major driver of polarization and kind of the politics of outrage. But in the financial situation that got brought in by the current NDP government. It is kind of a necessity for parties, and that's the structure of things. The Liberals'
promising sign for the opposition parties is this recent research poll that came out this week suggesting British Columbians are not feeling too optimistic. This poll looked at a number of issues and whether it's harder or easier for British Columbians to make ends meet versus 4 years ago. An overwhelming majority, 59% of the 800 people polled, said it was much harder to make ends meet versus only 7% in total who said it was easier. Things like buying a house were particularly harder, as 74% were very pessimistic about that. This isn't too surprising given COVID, but the government did run on a make life more affordable platform.
Yeah, so I can understand on why they say finding the job number got to be 49% saying harder. It was not a great time to be looking for work with everything shutting down and such over COVID. But there were some fairly significant supports, most notably the federal government's CERBN, the program that ended up replacing it type thing. And then the BC government kicked in the election bribe and some other like ICBC refunds and stuff that came in. So there's a decent amount of transfers to a lot of people. And in fact, that hasn't shown up in the making ends meet numbers. Ought to worry the BC government, but more specifically, that 74% number ought to really worry the NDP, because affordability is a huge challenge just generally in the province, and it was what they basically came to government on. And if after 4 years more people think it is tougher, not easier, and overwhelmingly harder to get a house, like, that is not going to be a good thing for the party. And it's going to be a weakness that can definitely be exploited by the opposition parties, particularly as you get further away from the past government. And this government now owns every mistake, every action that happens in the province, more or less, at least in the minds of voters.
Yeah, so a lot of the issues raised in this poll are interesting because they're kind of perception issues which can get detached from reality, like public safety. Has that improved or gotten worse? And a lot of people will say public safety is getting worse, even when statistics can show you that crime rates are going down in many different ways. Housing is definitely is harder to attain. That's objectively true in almost every single market I can think of in this province. Like, it is just expensive. And while things may have been churning around following the election and with some of the initial moves, COVID and just how things have gone have just blown out all of that. And it's significantly more expensive now to buy a house, to rent, etc. And there aren't quick and easy solutions. Even the let's just build is a 4 to 8 year solution. So that's the one that needs to be continually worried about. Even on healthcare, they're not doing too well, with only 11% saying it's getting better. Now, we just came out of a pandemic, so 4 years ago, I was probably more optimistic about our healthcare system than right in the middle of a pandemic, even though it survived. It just, you feel anxious about healthcare. So
yeah.
I think the one good thing for Horgan here is that 33%, the plurality, say it's too early to judge his accomplishments. 26% say he's only accomplished a little, and 21% say a lot. So there's still not like a groundswell against him personally over this.
But that'll change by the time the next election rolls around in 3 and a bit years. But like, looking through the numbers here, beyond the 30 to 50% up to 75 on the housing question. Just looking at everything else here. Beyond just those ones that are, say, something's gotten worse, but most issues clustering in the 30s to 50s. The number of people who say any policy area has gotten better is single digits, with the exception of healthcare, that just prats 11%. That is not the sign of a government that has actively managed to get a lot of kind of quality of life stuff. stuff done for people. Yeah, overall, this doesn't seem to be affecting Horgan's poll numbers particularly, but it does indicate, I think, some pretty significant weaknesses on the NDP's part that could very easily turn from just weakness into major liability come the next election.
In the next election, there will be a new BC Liberal leader, and one more MLA, one more party member has decided to throw their name into the ring, and that's MLA Renee Merrifield, the relatively green MLA, green meaning new in this case, MLA for Kelowna Mission. She is the current health critic for the party. And can I just say, Kelowna Mission is a very bizarre name for a riding. The first time I saw it, I was very confused because there's no constituency that goes all the way from the Okanagan to the Fraser Valley. There's just another mission in the province. And why? Anyway, Renee Merrifield, health critic, has previously had some weird takes about vitamin D and COVID.
Yeah, some weird gaffes on that.
Which is particularly bad for someone who's the health critic.
It's not great. She'd be long rumored to be running in this, or finger throwing her hat in the ring. I'm not entirely sure why, to be honest.
Did they just need a woman to run? I know that sounds a bit trite and diminishing of her own CV, but...
Well, she'd been rumored for long before many of the current Crawford candidates announced their intention, so I'm not sure it's that. But yeah, I'm not sure. I'm just not sure what the kind of specific reason why someone would jump from first-time MLA to leader, what the kind of case for that is. You have people who aren't currently serving who are running, but like with Gavin Dew, there is a coherent message on the justification for a leader and why bringing in someone from the outside makes sense. There just doesn't really seem to be that here. There's no, we need party renewal, generational change, be able to talk to younger British Columbians of the ridings we lost. You know, that's kind of the Gavin Dew value proposition. But like, I don't quite get what Renee Merrifield's is.
I think she's also relatively young, and so she can try and position herself in a similar way to that, although she doesn't represent... Kelowna's becoming a more urban riding, but it's metro van riding in the same way as Gavin Dew would be trying to pursue, and so she's not bringing that like urban approach. In her words to CBC, she says, people are looking for something different. They're looking for authenticity. They're looking for a fresh voice. She criticizes Kevin Falcon's discussion of talking about a new name, and she says just changing a name is like changing colors of lipstick, which I don't necessarily think is going to change who we are as a party. She is trying to have the party rethink a bit, which it's definitely necessary. Maybe there's something there. We'll try and get her on. We'll try and get everyone on to talk with them and find out what their pitch is in the coming weeks.
Moving on, as the fourth wave fueled by the Delta variant continues to pick up steam across the country, various political leaders are considering different types of actions to encourage vaccine uptake. Most notably, Trudeau has announced today that he is looking into the possibility of mandating vaccinations for public servants and people in federally regulated industries. So that would be like telecoms, banking, railroads, those ones, as well as anyone working for the federal government. As well, Quebec Premier announced that he's going to be bringing in a vaccine passport system in Quebec.
Yeah, and we also saw this week Dr. Bonnie Henry field some questions about mandatory vaccine passports. And while she hasn't said there's any need to push back the restart plans, and we should still go full steam ahead with that, she didn't shut the door down to further efforts on these kind of fields. We're talking about requiring vaccinations for services. She did emphasize that essential services would always be open to everyone regardless. I think that makes sense. We're not going to turn someone away from an ER because they didn't get vaccinated. I hope we will never be that cruel as a province, but for a lot of other areas, I think the consensus is really starting to shift and shift quick towards, we need to get a lot more people vaccinated. And if that means requirements along with your work, it's going to happen. Like, hell, even this week, it was like within hours, Andrea Horwath had tweeted out something about vaccines, mandating vaccines for teachers would violate their charter rights. And then Charlie Angus clapped back at her and a number of other articles went out, and suddenly she was rolling that back pretty hard.
So, yeah, it wasn't a tweet she sent out. She was on, I think it was Power and Politics, where she was criticizing Ontario Liberal leader Stephen Del Duca for suggesting that Ontario teachers should get be required to be vaccinated. And yeah, went on basically suggesting that requiring people who have a public-facing role and are in direct contact with a population group that cannot be vaccinated at this time should have the vaccine was a charter violation, which is rather doubtful. It's almost certainly can be saved on a Section 1 reasonable limits test, and there was likewise a argument that there would be a Section 7 violation for like an unsafe work environment.
Section 7, yeah, would be... Yeah, it depends on which side. Security of the person.
Yeah, security of the person. That, like, being needlessly exposed in the workplace, in a government workplace, would be a Section 7 violation. This is one of those areas where, like, it's... The more you talk about rights, the less clear it is, and the more just that's calling a big muddle rather than trying to figure out what's actually needed on this and how to kind of balance responsibilities. But regardless, that blew up very quickly online, and earlier today she beat a hasty retreat on it. But it was, yeah, a fairly big deal in Ontario politics. In fact, probably the most attention the Ontario NDP has gotten in years.
Not great going into an election soon in that province either.
Yeah, in the next year. Another year. Yeah. Let's face it, Andrea Horwath is not going to be premier before or after she said these things. It's not like they could really go down. But yeah, this is all interesting because I didn't feel the ground shifting on this one. Like a year ago when nobody had mandated masks in BC yet, we had this whole like hand-wringing thing about, is it even justified, or can we even bring in a mandatory mask thing? Yeah. But about all these various concerns and whatnot. And like, looking now, like, the attitude is clearly very different, where there is much more sense that, no, we need to do this, even if we haven't perfectly perfected all public policy enforcement mechanisms, which was the argument put forward by Bonnie Hendry a year ago. On why there shouldn't be mask requirements. And that has just basically gone away. And this past week, like, in addition to it, we've seen, I think, a couple other first ministers in a couple provinces start making noise about requiring vaccinations. And it's just very clearly the case that the public and the politicians are in a much different position on this. And doesn't seem like there's going to be much political upside anymore to coddling or pandering to the anti-vaxxers, as the NDP discovered this week.
I think the question for me on this has always come down to the public health efficacy question, because one of the reasons public health officials are reticent to recommend mandating things like this is the risk of exacerbating backlash. Like, it's one thing to strongly encourage it, but as soon as it becomes mandated, the conspiracy theorists have like extra fuel, and even people who are a bit hesitant will fall into two camps. They'll either go, okay, fine, I'll finally do it because I have to, or they might really backlash against it. And I don't, there's ways to balance it a bit better and do it a bit better. And I think I'm largely in support of these moves, but will they work is the ultimate question. Like, we're not seeing many countries around the world make this decision yet. I think it's starting to shift, but
yeah, the U.S.
That's what we need to be also watching for. We're not the only country playing this experiment out.
Yeah, I think it was this past week, Biden had definitely required the U.S. military to mandate vaccines, and I think was in the process of the Federal Civil Service in the same direction as well. A bunch of state governors have started to roll that out. So, like, we're in the spot now. Businesses, Facebook and Google come to mind, and governments are starting to require their employees to. I don't think we're...
You're also seeing governments in the U.S. go the exact opposite way, where they're banning, like, school districts from implementing mask mandates, which is wildly dangerous.
Yeah, although
they're
starting to roll that back. I think I saw the Arkansas...
As their people die.
Yeah, I think I saw the Arkansas governor was trying to get the bill he signed that did that repealed. Starting to change down there. Should not require this many hospitalizations and deaths for that to have happened, but nevertheless, here we are. We aren't quite at the point where there's, I think, a general sense that not just employees, but the general public should be subject to a vaccine mandate, but I get the feeling that's not far away. And today we crossed the 400 case per day mark. That continues to go up, and particularly if new restrictions are brought in to try and control that, like, I could pretty easily see the 80% of British Columbians, might even be a little higher now, who have gotten their first dose, and the over 60% who have gotten their second dose, basically also backlashing pretty hard against the selfish people out there who haven't, and not being too tolerant anymore of politicians kind of coddling them or taking...
Well, yeah, that's definitely the issue here. We're once again pitting people against each other instead of the government stepping in and actually doing the measures necessary to end this pandemic, or at least even mitigate it in the meantime. Like, yes, we should all be getting our vaccines, and if mandates are what it takes to make that happen. But we also have a bunch of other tools that we've proven worked, like shutting shit down, and we're not doing that. Like, even in the Okanagan, where the outbreaks are happening, all they did was say mask mandates are back on, but parties aren't shut down.
Yeah.
Like, they haven't stopped social gatherings again.
Yeah,
I don't get what's happening.
Yeah, in the hotspot areas, that should definitely be... They should be looking more at the non-pharmaceutical interventions, but vaccines are the most effective thing in all of this. And I could definitely see the case with if they do bring in those measures, which are probably likely the way things are going, that there does generate a lot of backlash from that. It wouldn't surprise me if in a couple of weeks' time we see more provinces announce vaccine passports, and maybe even one starting to float the idea of just a general public vaccine mandate, not just certain employees on that. And I don't think BC will do that, because we've taken a very hands-off approach to date, and we'll probably be one of the last provinces on that, but before Alberta. But other than that, we may be one of the last ones to actually act in that direction.
Anyway, if you haven't already, get both doses of your vaccine. I've got mine. I'm 2 weeks out. Most of the people in the Slack, I think, are there. It's good to see.
I'm a little over a month now on my second dose, which is more than a month, I think. So yeah, it's good to be on the other side, at least, and feel a bit better about this. So yeah, go get your vaccine, but keep up the other measures until this is well and truly over.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.